Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. Pete and I are off on one of our many walks down the Wolverhampton Canals, and today we're going to start with a quote from Alan Danielu, which is, "Yoga is often persecuted but often reborn." And I was just going to ask Pete about that quote and his thoughts about it.
See where it leads?
Yes.
Well, why would anybody want to persecute yoga?
Indeed.
In that particular book that the quote comes from, Alan Danielu talks about... it's not exactly a history of religion or a history of yoga. He's not trying to do that, but he's trying to give some shape to his experience of having living in Varanasi and practicing yoga for 20 years and learning the Vina and learning Sanskrit and translating loads of documents, and to make some kind of sense of that experience, and to try and have a historical sense while he's doing that.
Yeah.
The book's called Gods of Love and Ecstasy.
Which is a great title.
I know, yeah. And what he actually does is he makes comparative study between the Greek myths about Dionysus and the myths about Shiva, Shaivism. And
he sounds like a very interesting person. So just tell us a bit more about him before we carry on.
Yeah, as I said, he was deeply immersed in what he called the Hindu world. And he was a practitioner. I mean, he was a master Vina player, you know. So he got inside it, you know, and it had gone inside him. He was a Frenchman. And, you know, and he was pretty smart and had a lot of scholarly skills, but quite out to take histories of yoga and histories of India in its earliest times. It's very difficult. And I mean, Danielu in fact says that the book isn't a conventional history of religion. He's not attempting that. He's attempting something slightly different. But it does have this historical sense. And of course, he translates texts like the Shiva Puranas and the Rudra Shamhita and so on, and tantric texts, Mahanivana Tantra, etc. I mean, he was clued up about all of it. And he had a story to tell about that. And he thought that Shiva Dionysus and the worship of Shiva Dionysus was probably one of the earliest religions, and he appeals to archaeological evidence and textual evidence from the Greeks and so on to say that there was a proto-Shaivism that was practiced right away across the ancient world, right from India through the Middle East, Persia. The Greeks, of course, who documented their Dionysian cults right through into the Celtic world. Danielu says nobody can actually trace the true origins of Shaivism, you know, where actually it started. Danielu thinks that the Shaivism was a nature religion. And that the core practice was what he called yoga.
It's like, yeah. And how is that spelled?
Dash yoga.
Yeah.
And he proceeds to try and tell us about what it entails. Here. The thing that he likes to bring out in order to cast some light on the matter. Of these antecedents or these origins of Shaivism and yoga is the conflict between orthodox and orthodox religion with its associated social organisation and a more countercultural form of inquiry. At least it has long existed alongside. So George Feuerstein brings out the same tension in his account, in his huge book, which is called The Yoga Tradition. It's like a big encyclopedia, really.
Yeah.
Pretty useful.
There's quite a lot of interesting things in there, isn't there?
Yeah.
Strange and interesting.
Strange things, yeah.
Yeah. No.
Feuerstein traces this antipathy back to the central notion of renunciation. And he makes a point that in the Vedic period, you know, renunciation was symbolic for Orthodox people. You know, it was just an attitude of mind towards possessions and attachments and so forth. That you renounce them but carry on with your business. And obviously Orthodoxy had some stake in keeping society running.
Yeah.
If everybody dropped out, it would fall to bits. And whereas for people for whom renunciation had to be real, in other words, they had to become like sannyasins. And I'll quote Feuerstein about sannyasins, how they became quite a feature of post-Vedic society. And they're called avaduta, cast-offs is what it means. And they're kind of like crazy wisdom characters, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, he says that suddenly, or so it appears, a growing number of households left the villages and cities to live out the rest of their days in the wilderness, often on their own, but occasionally also with spouses. So there's this phenomenon. So you see, some people took it as symbolic, and they tended to be Orthodox and conservative and concerned with social, maintaining social order, and the others actually acted it out. And it's this kind of acting out of sannyasin that I think for Feuerstein seems to be the core of the various countercultural movements which have been spiritual practitioners, you know, yoga practitioners, Shaivites mostly. Well, right down, you know, on and off, in and out. You know, being suppressed and being reborn, as Daniela would have it, right the way through to the modern day.
Yeah.
In the post-Vedic period, there was a bunch called the Vrachyas, and they were described in some of the Sanskrit literature as despicable outcasts.
Oh.
You know, yeah. And they were, you know, really countercultural, and they actually kind of wandered around the place. They were kind of a bit mobile in groups, in small groups, 30 or something in a group. And Feuerstein finds in text references to pranayama that they practice, you know, and they were also magicians, and this was an era of magical thinking, of course, and they were magicians and concerned with that, and they also seem to be forerunners of medieval tantra, because they had a ritual called the Mahavrata, which entailed the bard of the group, and the group always had a bard, and the sacred prostitute of the group, and they always had one of them as well.
I like that.
Yeah, and they would have a ritual intercourse for magical and spiritual purposes.
Yeah.
You know, in order through the ecstasy to gain some insight into the nature of microcosm and macrocosm, which of course is, you know, yoga understood as an inquiry.
Yeah.
These counterculturals weren't happy with dogmatism, basically. You know, and there are always people going to pop up in any period who are not happy with dogmatism and will seek, sometimes within themselves, for something a bit more certain and reliable through meditation, through self-inquiry, through ecstasy. I mean, there was another lot, probably these were around earlier, and they were called Keshins, or the long hairs. And in one of the, in somewhere in the Vedas, there's a hymn to the Keshins.
Yeah.
And it's hymn to the long hairs, and what that is like, because you can see these are all in the same camp. You know, they're all of a type, these. These Keshins are very much like the Vrachyas.
Yeah.
And they, this hymn of the Keshins is like, it's an ecstatic, intoxicated song, you know, it's a song of intoxication, and it's incredibly Dionysian, or Bacchic, you might say, or tantric, you know, but it's very, very ancient, right there in the Vedic period, you know, I don't know, 4,000 to 6,000 years before Christ, you know, this is like four millennia before Christ, these guys hanging around, you know.
Yeah.
The Vrachas a bit later, these despicable outcasts. Interesting thing about the Vrachas, they were thought so despicable that it was permissible to sacrifice them in human sacrifice.
What?
Yep. And that is actually like
nice
in that, that is in the text. Anyway, I mentioned the sex ritual. The bard was meant to represent Rudra, who's like a fierce, the red one, a fierce aspect of Shiva.
Yeah.
And a figure, very much like Kali, a very fierce female destructive deity. I don't think the word Kali is mentioned there in that text. But she obviously, the Kali archetype is there. Yoga, understood this way, as the spiritual practice of a countercultural group, often persecuted, often reborn. And they do seem to be a type that's going to prefer questioning over dogmatism, and is prepared and is existentially driven to some kind of self-inquiry, obviously within a context that's specific to the, you know, the historical and cultural particulars surrounding the whole business. And it's interesting in this context. If you read the Shiva Puranas, that Shiva was very unrespectable. Yeah. In various incarnations, he was just like he would hang around on cremation grounds, covered in ash. Some people themselves like deformed, you know, and hung around with like robbers and pimps and drug addicts. And, pretty much the archetype of the outsider, of the countercultural outsider. Yeah. He's also the god of bang, you know, the god of intoxicating drugs, you know, and we think that the Vrachas and the Keshins experimented with soma, which is with spatna metaphors. A powerful psychedelic, probably, of some sort. You know, so all this is very, very unrespectable. And not everybody knew this bloke was actually like the great god, you know, and the giver to humanity of yoga and dance and intoxication. In fact, you know, a Dionysian, you know, the Indian Dionysus, or the Greek Dionysus is the Greek Shiva, you know. God of intoxication, God of sexuality, God of nature and nature energies. And of course, Shiva's always pictured with snakes, or he uses snakes as garlands or as scarves. You know, and snakes, as we've spoken before, are symbols of chthonic earth energy.
Yeah.
The earth of reproduction.
Yeah.
Of animal existence. Of course, Shiva is also lord of the animals, you know. Pashupati, lord of the beasts.
Yeah.
Very unrespectable.
Yes, not the god of conservative politics, then.
No, not at all. Unrespectability.
Not the god who likes his followers to be told what to do and bound up in many rules and regulations.
No, he's the breaker of rules and regulations. He's the breaker of distinctions. He's the breaker of caste, the breaker of patriarchy, the breaker of injunctions against intoxication, the breaker of puritanism, the breaker of assumptions about what actually a spiritual being is like, and where actually spiritual inquiry takes you. Yeah. And because, you know, in the lighter form of Shiva, where he's in there with the three gods, you know, like you've got creation, destruction, and preservation. You know, Brahma creates, Vishnu preserves, Shiva destroys. Yeah, so,
yeah.
And Bhairava, another Shiva form, is the destroyer. So, not respectable, hanging around on the burning grounds, with a load of drunkards and pimps. And Parvati, the lady of the mountain, encounters him, and she can kind of see through the scabbiness, you know,
yeah,
and the twisted limbs and the snakes and the dirt.
Yeah.
And says that actually, oh well, this chap actually, he's the universe, for fuck's sake, you know. So, and he says to her, well, I'll grant you a wish, but as you've seen, and she says to be my husband. Yeah. But I think she's kind of from a kingly family.
Yeah.
So
I take it she said yes.
They agreed to get married and have loads of sex.
Yeah.
Obviously, the family were a bit disturbed, you know, because he's like a bum. It's the story of girlfriend brings a bum home, you know.
Who happens to be, yeah, Shiva.
Yeah, and they have a massive parade when the groom is going to come to the wedding. And then they see like a palanquin, you know, like a sedan chair with a beautifully robed, very, very handsome man in it. And they say, is that Shiva? And Parvati says, no, that's not him.
And they go, oh, damn.
Yeah, that's his first minister.
Oh.
You know, and then somebody else comes along even more splendid, and that's his close advisor, you know, or his best friend or something.
Yeah.
And then when Shiva comes, he's this kind of like fucking dreadlocks and stoned off his face and drunk and not very respectable, you know. And there's a whole conflict about that. I mean, in the story, the purpose of the story is to... It's to, you know, it's to establish the genuine existential force of the counterculture, you know, and to poke a bit of fun at orthodoxy,
yeah,
and to poke a bit of fun at people's expectations of a kind of prissy, anodyne spirituality,
yeah,
noisy,
yeah,
you know. It's funny that the term that this guy gave yoga to humanity. But these days you hear the term, the insult, un-yogic, in the yoga community bandied about.
Yeah.
To mean somebody who's...
Which is important, and it's important that you say this, because
yeah.
This is used a lot to put people down who are trying to have a positive voice, not to be suppressed.
Yeah.
They go, oh, you're being very un-yogic.
Yeah.
And it's actually used to... put people down. So I'm really pleased that you mentioned this, because it's
okay.
Something that annoys me quite a lot.
Okay.
And yeah. if you're guilty of this, yeah, yourself.
Yeah.
Anna
says stop it.
Yes. Think about what you're doing and what you're saying.
Yeah.
If you accuse somebody of being un-yogic, really think about it. What are you doing? I mean, it could be true, but
you think some kind of...
I've never seen it used accurately before.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, un-yogic in that context means a bit like the prissy orthodox in the story, you know.
Yeah.
And by that take, Shiva is about as un-yogic as you can get, because he's so unrespectable. He's so rude.
Yeah.
So crazy that it's kind of... You know, it's a myth, obviously, but it's there. It does make a point, you know. So not only is like Daniello and Feuerstein, each in his own way, interesting in the way that they bring out this, you know, counterculture dash orthodoxy tension. But it's interesting that you find it like very, very, very clearly understood in mythic texts, namely the Shiva Purana and the Rudra Shamhita. So, chaps, I would say that yoga has many roots, many roots, but it has deep roots in the countercultural impulse.
Yes, and this is really why I wanted to do this podcast today, because of attempts to suppress yogis, regulate yogis, that's going on now.
Yeah.
I thought this was quite relevant.
Yeah.
Because it's always happened.
Yeah.
And, you know,
well, I mean, what
yogis can go their own way.
Yeah.
And they have. There's a history of them really having to fight to be able to go their own way.
Yeah. Well, do you know,
we're still doing it.
Yeah, it's it strikes me it is an archetypal tension that's bound to pop up whenever you know the cultural configuration is such that it can pop up. You know,
yeah.
Often suppressed, often reborn.
Yeah.
And the way this culture, this yoga culture, I suppose you might say, has kind of taken hold in the West. We've reached a point. Obviously, it's different in different parts of the world, but we do seem overall to have reached a point where this tension is bursting out in events and phenomena in the world and in the body politic. You know, I mean, our current situation is that some part of the yoga community wants to make deep alliances with the man.
Yeah.
If I can use some hippie terminology there.
Yeah.
You know, with an orthodoxy, with a social orthodoxy. I mean, that of this of kind of corporate governmental cabalism.
Yes.
You know, which kind of captures all aspects of life and exploits it. And in the case of yoga, it's kind of got pretty sucked into what you might call like the fitness industry. You know, the fitness, leisure, well-being. And these are kind of buzzwords that get thrown around. When you examine that part of the economy, and it is a cabal of dozens and dozens of different organisations and charities and movements and government departments and government quangos all meshed in together with a lot of public money sloshing around. I mean, the money tit is Sport England, from what I can see, which has almost half a billion, well, more than half a billion in money to splash around. So some people in the yoga community want to align to that, you know, want to be part of that. But I want to remind the yoga community of their countercultural roots.
Yes, you know. Me too.
You know, and I was a hippie, you know, and I buggered off to get away from everything up a mountain, and as you know, we were attracted to think all kinds of things Indian. You know, I just remember like hearing Ravi Shankar in the 1960s as a young man. You know, was teenager perhaps, and just been blown away, you know, what is this, oh my god, it was wonderful, you know. So we were into things Indian, we like, you know, hippies and sparkly things, anything exotic, you know.
Yeah. But it's pleasure, isn't it? Seeing these wonderful colours and the sparkly things and the shapes and the patterns is pleasure.
Yeah, well Shaivism, which is why Shaivism is natural to hippies, is not anti-pleasure.
Yeah.
You know, and that theme gets everything, all phenomena are pure. Shaivism is the source of yoga tantra, you know. You know, all phenomena are pure, and pleasure is the gateway, or the gateless gate, you know.
Yeah.
There is no yoga without bhoga. And it does envisage a form of the good life as being one in which people are relaxed and peaceful and celebrate. You know, and love pleasure, love music, love colour, love dance. And that yoga's a part of that. Yeah. It's a part of that celebration.
Yeah.
I mean, I keep saying, you know, let the yoga do you so that you kind of move. You move to move.
Yeah.
You move to dance through some kind of ecstasy. And this religion takes ananda or joy, you know, real spiritual joy to be part and parcel of the good life, the good human life. And it sees orthodoxy as generally being anti-pleasure, as suppressing pleasure, you know. These themes keep popping up all over the place, they're kind of perennial.
But also the pleasure of curiosity.
Absolutely.
And discovery.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
The pleasure of being unrestricted.
Yeah, absolutely.
And being able to explore in the way that you want to.
Yeah.
I mean, this is actually a pleasure too, in a way.
Of course. Of course, even though, of course, you know, Bhairava, Rudra, Shiva challenges and destroys your presuppositions about everything, you know, or your received ideas that have come to you from the orthodoxy that you're exposed to. If you're in a society that educates children to any degree, you know, it actually calls all that in question.
Yeah.
It's why I think somebody who's who's come to yoga from that countercultural angle with those countercultural impulses isn't going to be conservative, small c, big c.
No.
It kind of don't figure. Because you see, I don't know what the word here would be, you know, the damage, the restriction of dogmatism. And dogmatism, of course, is usually what feeds some kind of orthodox social structure with an orthodox religion to back it up. Obviously, we live in funny times. We have a religion of money and things like that. So.
Yeah. I mean, I feel that part of the restrictions that are trying to be placed upon us now are to do with money.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think that this was so for the long hairs, the Kleshins, do you think money Kleshins, was involved Kleshins. In trying to suppress them? Or do you think it was something else?
Who knows, you know. I think when you get a group wants to leave society, there's something wrong with the society. If it was a great society, you wouldn't want to leave. So it must have been stopping them from doing something that they really wanted to do.
Yeah.
You know, which was to live this, which was to explore themselves, consciousness, by whatever means, including sex, including drugs, including rock and roll by the sound of it. But also with some with a certain discipline and a certain understanding of how to inquire into these matters, you needed to open yourself in some way. You know, you wouldn't see any of this from inside of a tight ego prison. You wouldn't see it. But, you know, and there were various moves from what we can make out to suppress these guys at times. But other times they formed alliances and they kind of got into respectable society. It's like they couldn't be ignored, you know. I mean, at one point, I mean, again, going back into the Vedic period, the Orthodox came through with an idea that they could develop a rite which would purify a Vraitya, you know, one of these despicable outcasts, and allow him or her to be introduced back into society.
How nice for them.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, there's a lot of push and pull, and the way we've described it, and the way Daniello described it, and the way Feuerstein describes it, is obviously vastly oversimplified, you know, and we're just working with these hasty periodisations of big lumps of time, thousands of years. You know, it's a sketch, but there's enough evidence, I think, to tell us that this stuff has been going on a long time.
Yeah.
You know, and if you wanted to characterise it with something simple, probably over simple, you'd just say it was like countercultural. Stroke, orthodoxy, tension. Historically, you know, that plays out in different ways, especially when people are wanting to self-inquire, when that urge in human beings finds a gap.
Yeah.
You know. Anyway, I mean, I'd as I say, as you mentioned, you know, we seem to be in the middle of all that again. I don't think we're going to be taken off and human sacrificed yet. But as we know, you know, the modern age isn't averse to the odd bit of human sacrifice, is it?
Yeah. We've kind of got the modern equivalent, really. I mean, being forced to conform is almost killing off part of you, isn't it?
It feels like it, yeah. It's not very nice when that happens. I think people do have to decide which way they're going to jump on this one. Even though I dare say of the 10,000 yoga teachers in the UK, probably quite a lot are not even aware, I don't know for sure.
Well, and I know
you don't see these things unless you see them.
I know that many, there are many yoga teachers, yoga practitioners who are very strong, very vocal, and will not be silenced.
No.
But unfortunately, there's, and this is another thing that prompted me to want to do this podcast today, is that there is quite a lot of what I experience as timidity in the yoga community.
I've seen a bit of that.
And I was hoping that maybe those listening to this podcast, if you are feeling a bit timid and like you need to toe the line,
be brave.
Yeah.
And mighty forces will come to your aid.
Indeed. To this, to illustrate that this fight for the freedom to really explore yourself has always been going on. So you're not alone.
No.
I think part of the reason for the timidity is maybe people feel a bit isolated and they're being told what to do.
Yeah.
And no one around them is really piping up. I know, because I've seen it, that there is no one, practically no one, who practices yoga, teaches yoga, is involved in the deep self-inquiry, who wants to be suppressed, regulated, and controlled.
Yeah. Either by stealth, which of course is the modern way.
Yeah.
You don't get like a law that says you've got to pack it in, otherwise we're going to chop your head off. You just get the kind of stealth and the slow or fast even envelopment in the cabal.
Yeah.
You know, or one of the cabals, seduced by the money and the status, which will affect the rest. You know, the people who are hovering, who don't know they've just got to get on and do their own thing and build their own thing, will kowtow, you know, and will change what they do and pay the expense that will involve, rather than actually stand up and say, fuck you.
Yeah.
So, but we'll see, basically. I mean, I hope I'm not being... I'm kind of fairly optimistic, because they've tried this before.
Yeah.
A couple of times in my lifetime, you know.
What's going on now is not a new thing.
No, and now with social media and so forth, the opposition is more vocal, more practical, more focused.
More organised.
Even though it's kind of chaotic, it's a kind of chaotically organised,
yeah.
And there's all sorts of stuff going on. Some of it for reasons which are nothing to do with what we've just talked about, but nevertheless, which are pulling in the direction of preserving the counterculture. You know.
So, if you are aware of what's going on in the yoga world at the moment and the attempts to try and suppress it and control it, but feel alone and
you are not
a bit timid, you're not alone. Lots of people are with you, just need to reach out to them. Yeah. And if you find that you are surrounded by people who just want to follow the rules and toe the line, then break out of your circle and go somewhere else. Walk away, because you can. And if you feel that you're teaching somewhere that restricts you, like a sports centre or somewhere that's putting you in a box, and you don't feel that you're giving your students what you know you can give them, I would highly encourage you to start your own class somewhere where you can control the environment and you're in charge of what you can really do.
We are, I would say, as a community, ready to, you know, take yoga all over the place. I mean, it's already, like people going about getting it in schools, it's already in schools. There's thousands of teachers working in schools.
Yeah.
And in the health service, already in the health service. You know, so I'm not against that. I think we've got to like isolate ourselves in ashram communities. I don't think that'd be cool. I mean, that works for some people, and that's great too.
Yeah.
But it's in our own terms.
Yeah, you know? I mean, if you can teach in that environment on your own terms, that's really great. In my experience, I never could.
No.
And I worked in a chain of sports centres, and I went round, and they were different facilities and vastly different rooms, but they were always problematic. Pounding music coming through the walls, a glass wall through to the spin class where the teacher is screaming at the students with a head mic.
It's been a while ago.
And all that sort of stuff. And I never found in those environments that I could give what I could give at the Parkdale Yoga Centre, that's for sure. Although I could definitely give them something.
Yeah, yeah.
There was, I could give them something, but the environment was always pulling against me.
Yeah. But this question about the countercultural attributes of yoga, it goes deep. It goes deeper than these kind of basic concerns, and specific concerns that the so-called yoga teacher has in our society. It's a much kind of bigger thing, Otherwise, we could probably ignore it. and leave everything just to do what it does, and it wouldn't matter, and in some kind of sense it don't matter. But it is a bigger question, because it'll determine the way in which yoga naturalises itself right in the threads, in the warp and the weft of our culture, which is happening. But if we come to understand yoga through a set of bureaucratic ideas about it, and bureaucratic impositions upon it, the public understanding of yoga will be distorted, and narrowed, and truncated, and attenuated, and all those words.
Yeah, and that would be tragic.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it needs to at least remember, and we modern Western yogis, and diaspora yogis over here in the West, need to remember our countercultural roots.
Yeah.